From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was the deadliest mass shooting in the United States ever. A gunman opened fire at a popular gay nightclub in Orlando. 50 people, including the gunman, are dead. Many more injured and fighting for their lives. The shooter was reportedly homophobic and pledged allegiance to ISIS, which has embraced him as a martyr. This hour on Point, the massacre in Orlando. You can join us on air or online. What are your emotions the day after this horrific massacre? What can we do to stop homegrown terror? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Orlando, Florida, is Catherine Welsh. She is news director at Orlando's NPR affiliate, WMFE. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jane.
You've been immersed in this since it happened. What is the latest on the investigation?
So what we're getting really is just more details of what happened inside that nightclub in the early morning hours of Sunday. So a sense of what happened, an officer who was working as a security guard forced the gunman into a bathroom. And at that point, it became a hostage situation. During a police briefing on Sunday, they told us they were getting calls from the bathroom, giving them a sense of scope. Police worried about more loss of life. The officers decided to go in. They tried to blast their way in. That didn't work. So they rammed a hole in the wall of the bathroom with a SWAT vehicle. At that point, gun battle ensued. Officers shot the gunman. And what they had told us in earlier press briefings, police say 30 people were rescued from that situation. Now, 49 victims, one shooter dead. Almost all of them have been identified. All of the bodies have been removed from the nightclub, but about half of the families have been notified.
And what about the injured? Is the death toll expected to rise?
We're waiting for word from the hospital. As you can imagine, with HIPAA laws, they're being very tight-lipped on that. We have a reporter trying to get that information right now.
What about the gunman, the 29-year-old security guard? What more do we know about him today?
What we know is he was a security officer in Port St. Lucie. He lived in a neighboring town called Fort Pierce. To give your listeners a sense of geography, it is relatively between Orlando and Miami. It's on the coast, a very affluent neighborhood. We know he wanted to be a police officer. He was working in security. Now, his ex-wife told reporters in Boulder, Colorado, that he was bipolar, and that she believes that the shootings were not related to any religious ideology, but to his mental illness. Now, other witnesses say that he attended evening services 3 to 4 times a week at his local mosque, and that he didn't really socialize to people. He came and he left, didn't really talk to others.
And what about the weapons that he used? Apparently bought in the last couple of weeks?
Bought legally in the last couple of weeks, and it was an assault rifle and a handgun. And early on, police had said he had had some suspicious device on him. We have not received any clarification on that.
Let's hear some sound here from some of those people who were near the Pulse nightclub at the time of the shooting. Here's Christopher Hansen speaking with Orlando's ABC affiliate WFTV.
Bang, bang, it sounded like it was a song. All I know is that when I turned around, everyone was screaming and jumping, and we just all dodged. I remember getting pummeled. I was helping somebody. I saw somebody got shot, and there was blood all over.
And here are some eyewitness accounts from outside the nightclub right after the shooting. This aired last night on NBC's Dateline.
My son was in the club with his boyfriend, Juan, and Juan got shot multiple times.
People on the ground bleeding, people screaming.
I could just smell the ammo in the air, and I was like, this is a gun. This isn't fireworks. Like, we need to leave.
Catherine Welsh, what do we know about passive or active communication with any overseas extremists?
We know very little. The FBI are being tight-lipped. All that we've heard so far locally in the press conferences is that they were investigating him in 2013, And again, in 2014, in 2013, he had said something publicly about some kind of attack. And then in 2014, he had made some kind of contact that put them on, Mateen on their radar screen. But they really didn't go any further with that. Now, his father has told reporters that he did not think that this was terrorism related.
We're starting to get the names and the stories of some of those people who died. Talk about the outpouring of love and support for those who died there in Orlando in the massacre.
You know, it started almost immediately with the blood bank. They put a call out, obviously. I mean, when you have 53 injured and a mile long was the line. People waited in hours. We had reports in Daytona Beach, which is about an hour away. There just happened to be a blood drive that day. Lines for that as well. Also, we have a very iconic park here in Orlando. It's in downtown park. It's at a place called Lake Eola. And there was a call on social media to hold a candlelight vigil there. The city begged for it to not happen. They were worried about safety issues. And it went on anyway, scores of people showing up to that vigil. One of the more iconic gay clubs, gay bars in Orlando, it's called the Parliament House. They had a huge vigil there for the LGBT community. This morning, people showing up. We have a lovely performing arts center in downtown Orlando, one of those nice modern architecture buildings with a front lawn. They're asking people or letting people know that they can drop things off, pictures, flowers, candles, remembrances to create a memorial there. I can also tell you, Jane, that those signs that you see, like up and down the street, you know, chicken sandwich, $2.99, those signs are changing to praying for Orlando all over town.
Catherine Welch is news director at Orlando's NPR affiliate WMFE. Catherine, thanks so much for your great reporting and for being here today.
Thank you.
Well, with me here now in the studio is J.M. Berger. He's a fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University and associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism at The Hague. He is co-author with Jessica Stern of ISIS, The State of Terror, and author of Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam. J.M., so great to have you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So all hands on deck now as this investigation moves forward. What's the critical component now? Is it tracking the gunman's communication, his phone, his computer, trying to determine if others are involved? I mean, where do they go from here?
Definitely. The electronic exploitation is the big piece that has to happen right now. The question is going to be, was he consuming ISIS propaganda? Was he in contact with ISIS members electronically, people here or people overseas? At the same time, they are also making interviews in the community. Orlando has a long and colorful history of jihadist sympathizers, and the social networks, you know, we're accustomed to thinking about them being online these days, but they are in the real world too.
Of course, we know the 911 call during the attack where the gunman pledged allegiance to ISIS. Yesterday, ISIS claimed responsibility for the Orlando attack in a written statement. And last night, the attack in Orlando was top story on ISIS's daily news broadcast in English. ISIS said the gunman had pulled off the deadliest attack on American soil since 9/11, or the Manhattan Raid, as the announcer calls it. The sound I'm going to play for you right now was provided us by our guest, J.M. Berger. Here it is.
We begin in America, where our brother Omar Mateen, one of the soldiers of the Khilafah in America, carried out an attack on a nightclub for sodomites in the city of Orlando, Florida. He succeeded in massacring the filthy crusaders, killing and injuring more than 100 of them before he was killed. The operation was reported as being the most deadly attack in America since the Manhattan Raid 16 years ago. May Allah accept our brother among the shuhada.
Is this a claim of responsibility, JM, or is ISIS just attaching itself to this later?
It's an adoption of the attack. You know, the model that ISIS uses is to try and inspire lone wolf attacks. Obviously, they do have what we call external operations capability, where they can put sleeper cells or agents undercover in a country to carry out activities. But ISIS has been extraordinarily successful at inspiring people to carry out attacks on their own. much more than any other terrorist group. This tactic's been around for decades, and no one has really managed to operationalize it like ISIS has.
Well, in fact, ISIS had called for a surge in violence during the month of Ramadan, right, promising a reward tenfold in the afterlife. They do seem to be, by this clip that you've given us, accepting this gunman into the community of martyrs.
Yes. I mean, you know, we're still waiting to find out. The electronic exploitation is really going to clarify whether this guy was really following the ISIS playbook. But his activities were very similar to what we've seen in other ISIS attacks. In Paris, the attackers tried to call emergency services to make a statement. They weren't able to get through, but they tried. That's part of what's advised. The attack during Ramadan, also the most recent statement by ISIS's number two guy, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, called for attacks on soft targets. He brought up the fact, as we've seen in many lone wolf attacks, that people who are carrying out attacks on their own, they don't like to attack civilians. They would rather attack a military target. It's more morally comfortable for them. So, you know, there was an explicit argument that they should hit softer targets.
NBC News is reporting just now, in fact, that federal officials are investigating 2011 and 2012 trips to Saudi Arabia taken by the gunman. A spokesman for Saudi Arabia's interior tells NBC that Omar Mateen performed an umrah, which is, a lesser pilgrimage during that time.
Right. The Hajj is the greater pilgrimage. Every Muslim is required to do that once in their lifetime. Umrah is a lesser pilgrimage. It could very well just be that. Certainly, this was prior to ISIS, so he didn't, you know, meet ISIS while he was there. But what we're seeing in this case, and we've seen in a number of other cases, is people who have radicalized under the al-Qaeda paradigm during the al-Qaeda days, and then they subsequently carry out action in the name of the Islamic State.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the massacre in Orlando this hour, and you can join the conversation. A lone wolf, a soft target, what is law enforcement to do? Gay Americans, how are you processing this? My guest this hour, J.M. Berger, a fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University, co-author of ISIS, The State of Terror, and author of Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam. Here's some sound. Tiffany Johnson, a bartender at Pulse, that nightclub, told reporters that she was out on the patio when she heard shots being fired inside.
I'm hurt. I'm saddened. I don't really know what to do at this point, but just try to help as much as I can. I just want to make sure that the people that I know and love are okay who are in there.
And today, the Orlando gunman's father spoke to the press and publicly apologized for the massacre and said he had no idea what motivated his son.
I'm sorry again. And it is a very sad news today for all American, and I'm very, very mad. And I, as I said, if I did know of 1% that he is committing such a crime, my son, I would arrest myself, I would call the FBI, I would call the local law enforcement. I don't know why he did, what he did.
Well, he said he had no idea what motivated his son. However, yesterday, NBC News reported, Pete Williams described a conversation with the shooter's father that an NBC producer had about his son's hatred of gay people.
He, the father, Mateen, the son, and Mateen's son, young son, were in Miami, and according to the father, saw men kissing, touching each other. This outraged Mateen. He said to his father, they're doing this in front of me and my son. And his father thinks that this, in other words, is what touched this off.
J.M. Berger, I mean, we clearly have some homophobia here. And whether the ISIS attachment comes later, I mean, who knows?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still waiting on the details of what his involvement with ISIS are. But certainly being homophobic and being an ISIS supporter are not incompatible in the slightest. They go hand in hand. ISIS has persecuted gay people in its territories rather aggressively. They throw them off of buildings to execute them. And, you know, their supporters online talk about it a lot. And they're clearly somewhat obsessed with the topic. So, you know, it could be a case of similar interests, or it could be a case where one of these drives in him trumps the other one.
One of our listeners asks online here, the fact that he called 911 to swear allegiance to ISIS looks like a desperate attempt to rationalize, excuse, or elevate his murders to something more than just homophobic acting out. Let me bring another voice in here now from Austin, Texas. Peter Blair, director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center at Texas State University. He's also co-author of the FBI's study of active shooter incidents. A video based on Peter's work is at our website, onpointradio.org. Peter, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane.
So you've been looking at these mass shooters generally, speaking, analyzing them, their behaviors. What are you seeing? What does your analysis show? What are the patterns you're picking up?
Well, this is what I would say is the fourth in a series of inspired-type terrorist attacks that have happened in about the last calendar year. So we had one in Garland, Texas last May, then Chattanooga, Tennessee in July of 2015, San Bernardino in December of 2015, and now Orlando here in 2016. So that's four attacks we've seen from these people who are not directly controlled by a terrorist organization but have some loose affiliation or swear some allegiance to that organization. Also what's of concern to us is that as we've seen these attacks unfold, they become more deadly.
Well, you also talk about the fact that these shooters study each other, which holds true in this case. In the 911 call, the gunman made reference to the Boston bombers, right? The Tsarnaev brothers. I mean, it turns out like each case is something of a blueprint for the next attacker. Is that right?
That's true. We definitely have seen that attackers look to each other's previous attacks. They look at what worked, what didn't work, and they're always trying to cause more damage, kill more people.
J.M. Berger, how is it that someone who was interviewed two or three times by the FBI, I've heard both numbers, on an FBI watch list is still able to purchase weapons?
Well, in the United States, regardless of your feelings on gun control, if you haven't committed a crime, then you are not subject to criminal penalties. Now, the one exception of this is terrorism-related. It's the no-fly list. You can be put on no-fly lists without any kind of charge, without any publicly available evidence. So, you know, that's a comparison that President Obama has made is, you know, we should treat gun purchases in the same way that we treat the no-fly list.
Right. But all these years after 9/11, after Newtown, San Bernardino, Virginia Tech, Charleston, I mean, the list goes on. Why aren't these databases talking to each other? Right. Why aren't they getting together? Why don't we know who the FBI is talking to? Who's buying weapons? I mean, can't we cross?
Well, there's an intractable political problem in this country over gun control, which is that there's a really entrenched opposition to it that prevents things from happening. So some of this stems from that there are actual restrictions on how people can, you know, transfer information, how they can share information about gun buyers.
All right, let's get some listeners in here. A lot lined up to join the conversation. First to Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Laura. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane.
Yes.
First of all, I want to extend my heartfelt sadness and love out there to the gay community worldwide. I think hate talk is definitely alive and well in this country. I think actually Trump said it well when he said, we have people that hate in this country. Well, he's right. We've got people that have been in this country for generations. They're white. They're usually male. And they hate people. They hate gays. They hate women. They hate black people. They hate Latinos. This hate talk can't be outlawed. It shouldn't be. That's a right we have. But we should not condone it. We should stand up against it. Our leaders should. I think Hillary, her war hawk is kind of coming out right now. She needs to really scale it down and talk about what's going on in our own country.
It's when the hate talk turns to the Terrorist Act, I guess, that we have the issue. JM, let me play this for you. Laura, thank you for the call. Here's a news conference yesterday. Supervising Agent Danny Banks with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement calling the nightclub shooting a terrorist attack.
We are investigating this from all parties' perspective as an act of terrorism. Any time that we have potentially dozens of victims in any of our communities, that I think we can qualify that as a terrorist activity.
J.M. Berger, I mean, these mass shootings are law enforcement's worst nightmare, right? Soft targets, lone wolf. What's the lesson here, that a man or a woman with a gun, it's nearly impossible to stop them?
Well, we have seen tremendous advances in our responses to mass shooting incidents. You know, there's a playbook, there's specialized training, there are specialized units. But you know, this can only go so far. We can't be everywhere all the time. You can't prevent everybody from doing anything. You know, in a case like this, there's bigger questions than we usually see, because there's previous FBI investigation of this guy. You know, we're going to find out what his electronic communications were, whether there's something, clues that could have been missed there. You know, so every time something like this happens, we go back and we do this postmortem because we want to know, you know, what could we have done differently, and we try and learn from each attack.
Peter Blair, you can't possibly anticipate who's going to be next, or can you?
Well, there's not a set profile for these people as far as demographics go. What we oftentimes see, though, is that they are in a downward spiral, becoming more and more angry. In the case of these radicalized individuals, we see them reaching out to more and more radical ties. So there is some possibility to identify people before they actually launch the attack, but it is difficult to do.
Let's go to Jackie in Nashville, Tennessee. Jackie, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Okay, so I got to see some of the surviving members of the Grateful Dead perform at Bonnaroo yesterday, and I thought one of the members made a great point when he said that, you know, this attack was obviously an act of hate, but he was also really worried about the sort of retaliation and revenge that a lot of people seem to want to enact in response to this. And he says that, like, you know, that sort of mentality is, you know, that would just almost be bad as ISIS.
Jackie, thank you. Jay Amberger?
Well, ISIS is particularly adept at hitting fracture lines in societies and trying to spark cycles of violence. And whether or not Mateen was in contact with ISIS, you know, this kind of attack really is perfect ISIS kind of attack. It hits on fracture lines. There's a huge political division in this country right now. It's going to spark pretty acrimonious discussion about gun control, I think. Obviously, we're expecting a speech from Donald Trump later today that is probably going to throw some fuel on the fire of xenophobia. So you know, there's a lot of anger in the gay community. I saw a lot of people saying yesterday, it's like, you know, politicians who are standing up to express their sorrow and solidarity with the gay community who have traditionally stood against rights for the gay community.
Speaking of the gay community, let me bring in another voice here from Orlando. Hannah Willard is Policy and Outreach Coordinator for Equality Florida, an LGBT civil rights organization. Hannah, great to have you with us today.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. Our hearts are with you, Hannah. What are your thoughts on this very difficult day after?
We are still reeling, to be honest. I woke up this morning feeling like yesterday was just a terrible nightmare, although we did have moments of hope, moments of beauty in our city beautiful, what we call Orlando here. This is my hometown. This is where I grew up. This is where I live. And for Orlando to be the center of this senseless violence is truly heartbreaking. Unfortunately, the LGBTQ community is no stranger to violence and hatred and antagonism, and we're shaken that this senseless violence targeted our community this past weekend.
There was more than one report yesterday of the fear of copycat incidents after the Orlando nightclub massacre. And surely, you know, across the country in Santa Monica, there was an arrest of a man who told investigators he was going to a Pride Day festival. He had a cache of weapons, ammunition, explosive-making materials in his car. The feeling, Hannah, in the LGBT community in Orlando and around the country today?
There's a lot of fear. Certainly there was so much panic in those first few moments as we all sent frantic text messages and made phone calls yesterday morning. But there certainly is a lot of fear now. We, as I mentioned, we're no stranger to being targeted for violence and hatred, but this is absolutely so close to home that it happened in a gay nightclub. Gay nightclubs are safe havens for the LGBT community. For so many of us, they are really the first place where we feel that we can be our authentic selves. They're places where we can hold hands with our significant other. They're places where we can dance with our friends. And it's shocking to me that that safe haven was violated in this way. It's also prescient that this attack happened during June, during LGBT Pride Month. This is a month that LGBT people gather across the country, across Florida, at pride marches and parades and festivals where we celebrate our identities. We celebrate our pride, and we mark the Stonewall Riots. The Stonewall Riots, of course, being the protest in the 1960s where gay and transgender people took action against our oppressors. We took action against our opponents, and we've done that in the past. We'll continue to do that in the future, and we are absolutely moving forward stronger and in solidarity together in the midst of our grief.
NBC News reported that the gunman had been incensed by the scene of two men kissing recently. And this is complicated, of course, because the gunman also pledged allegiance to ISIS, which we've been discussing here in that 9/11 call during the attack. What do you want people to know about your community, Hannah, after this horrific event?
I want people to know that there's no question that homophobia and bigotry and hatred are alive and well here in Florida and across our country. We know that. In 2016 alone, there were over 175 anti-LGBT bills filed in legislatures across the country. Our community is under attack, period. While we are celebrating how far we've come, we're just a couple weeks away from the one-year anniversary of marriage equality, we've barely scratched the surface of what it means to fully achieve equality under the law for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Americans. We have so much further to go to uproot homophobia, bigotry, and hatred anywhere it exists. And in the midst of our grief, we are even further resolved to uproot that hatred anywhere, whether it be homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia, racism, sexism. There's so much intersectionality here. There's so much of a need to come together as marginalized communities and fight back against our opponents, because the reality is we have the same opponents. We're working against the same folks who wish to deny us our safety, deny us our equality under the law. And I'm inspired in the midst of this heartbreak that we have had such intersectional solidarity here in Orlando and across the country as we've worked to prevent any sort of senseless violence like this from happening again.
Again, Hannah Willard, thank you so much for your time. Policy and Outreach Coordinator for the Equality Florida Civil Rights Organization for the LGBT community. Really appreciate your time. Thank you, Hannah, very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Let me get another call in here. Anna in Olympia, Washington. You're on the program. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to send my condolences to the victims and their families. I also wanted to mention that I'm a male-to-female transgender woman. I'm also a combat veteran. I served in combat operations in Iraq. And I just wanted to encourage people not to fall for Islamophobia, to avoid that, because I served alongside Muslim people that, you know, were fighting on the right side. I mean, it's really scary because I almost see... I mean, I just want to see people avoid making the same mistake that was made back in 1942 with the Japanese Americans. And I just hope people don't think that, I just hope people don't fall to Islamophobia.
Right, Anna, thank you so much. Peter Blair, it's an interesting point. I mean, this could shift the other way.
Well, we certainly have seen that of the active shooter attacks that happen in the United States, that there are relatively few of them that are inspired by Islamist terrorist type people. Most of them tend to be people who are not affiliated with any sort of terrorism operation.
Peter Blair, any thoughts? Jan Berger, any thoughts about that as we head to break here?
Well, yeah, we are seeing, what we're seeing now is that people who have existing issues, who may have violent tendencies, are increasingly able to access an ideological justification, whether or not they're deeply committed to it. And ISIS has been particularly good at inspiring that kind of association.
Peter Blair, I just want to thank you for your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're following the story of the mass shooting at the gay nightclub in Orlando this hour, and you can join the conversation after Newtown, Virginia Tech, Charleston, San Bernardino. What is this country going to do? My guest this hour, counterterrorism expert J.M. Berger. I want to play some sound yesterday from the White House, President Obama, speaking about the massacre in Orlando.
Today marks the most deadly shooting in American history. The shooter was apparently armed with a handgun and a powerful assault rifle. This massacre is therefore a further reminder of how easy it is for someone to get their hands on a weapon that lets them shoot people in a school or in a house of worship or a movie theater or in a nightclub. And we have to decide if that's the kind of country we want to be. And to actively do nothing is a decision as well.
We talked about this in the break, J.M. Berger. The president refers to it here. You know, places like Charleston, San Bernardino, these fuzzy connections to extremism.
Yeah. I mean, what we're seeing is an environment now where people who want to carry out violence are finding it easier and easier to hang that violence on a cause. So, you know, and it's often very unclear how deeply committed to the cause they are, how educated about the cause they are. I think this is largely a function of electronic communications and social media. It's much easier to discover extremist communities than it used to be. In the old days, you know, if you were an extremist, violent extremist, you had to operate underground. If you wanted to find out about violent extremism, you would have to meet somebody who is potentially violent, expose yourself to risk, and those factors have changed dramatically now. So you can have a very casual engagement and take action and hang your action on that ideology without having a deep knowledge of it.
Is it? I mean, it's just another example, really, of ISIS innovating, right? Changing its methods. Instead of trying to entice young people to travel to the Middle East, just encouraging them to stay home and wage jihad here.
Well, I mean, the concept of this sort of lone wolf terrorism has been around since the 80s. It originated with white supremacists, and nobody's been able to make it work until now is the difference. ISIS is exploited social media, exploited internet connectivity in ways that we have not seen other extremist groups do, but they're not going to be the last. They just happen to be the first ones to stumble onto the formula. We're going to see more of this. We're going to see a renaissance of extremism going forward because extremist networks will adapt to these technological changes faster than mainstream counters will adapt.
I don't want to forget the victims here. Let's hear more sound from Sunday. This is CBS's Scott Pelley speaking with eyewitness Sean Royster. Royster was outside the club when he heard the gunshots. He climbed over a back wall and ran away.
I didn't know which way they were coming from. They sounded close. They sounded far. They sounded close. They sounded far. And it would stop for about 2 seconds. And then, I ended up going underneath someone's truck. Just until it got done, until something calmed down, some kind of calm, because it was just mayhem everywhere.
And this is the Orlando Police Chief, John Mina, speaking at a news conference, saying that when his officers entered the nightclub, they were shocked at the carnage inside.
There were more victims inside than originally thought. So once it was safe for us to go in and we determined there were no devices, that's when we were able to discover how many victims were actually in there.
Let's get more calls here. Kelly in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Kelly. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
So as a gay American here in Nashville, I went to and participated in a beautiful vigil for Orlando last night, and very emotional. And, as a gay American, it's really hard to, what can I do to keep me and my partner safe as we participate in Pride in the next few weeks? And what does this mean as far as, like, watching my surroundings and not only being an American but being gay American? So it's a really eye-opening experience. I felt kind of I've heard people say a dreamlike state, but that's how I felt the morning of when I got the notification and my mom called me. So it was very scary.
Kelly, thanks so much. I appreciate your call very much. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Greg is on the line. Hi, Greg. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My feelings are that there are no pathways of sociopathic behavior. You get stuck on the freeway, and you really want to, you know, what stops us from, you know, these sorts of things? And the message that I received from my dear mother was do no harm. And the campaign I have is to heal, not kill, here in Detroit. I don't care who you sleep with, you know, I'm heterosexual, but we have to find a way to engineer a healing process where it is not necessary that we have to pull a gun, that we have to go to war. We must evolve as a species.
I hear your message, Greg, and it's a good one. Thanks for stating it here today. Appreciate your call very much. Debbie is in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Debbie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Just wanted to share a thought with you. I'm a Texas transplant, actually, and in the town where I'm from, we now have something called open carry. And I know this is going to sound crazy, but the reality is I don't think we'd ever be able to eradicate guns from everyone, but what if guns were more accessible to people in their right mind who were licensed, who were responsible? In a situation like this, 50 people wouldn't be dead. It could have been taken care of if there was one person who was armed, the way police are, the way we have people who are trained who carry weapons. I'm not saying anyone can have a gun, but I think in the town where I'm from, thus far in open carry, there has been one mishap where a man shot someone who was stealing. But outside of that, it's not been the mayhem that I think people think it would be.
Debbie, thanks so much for the call. A lot of talk online about gun control. There's Debbie in Texas talking about open carry. Here's some comments online. Joe says, imagine if the assault weapons ban had not expired in 2004. Who might be alive right now? Another listener, unfortunately, there will still be IEDs, as we've seen in Boston, Brussels, and Baghdad. Abigail says, look at the strict gun laws in places like Oslo and Paris. Then revisit the subject. J.M. Berger.
Well, I mean, I'm ambivalent about a lot of the gun control conversation that I see. But, you know, in terms of, you know, increasing gun ownership, you can certainly point to places where everybody has guns and it's not very safe, such as Yemen or Somalia. At the same time, you know, I grew up around guns. I'm comfortable around them. I grew up around responsible gun owners. But what really we're talking about here, I think, when it comes down to it, is the type of weapon. So, I mean, without hugely engaging in the debate myself, I would say that the debate is really about what kind of weapon allows you to kill 50 people in 10 minutes. So, you know, people rightly point out that there will always be violence, whether people have guns or not. There's stabbing attacks. There's machete attacks. It's very difficult to do that much damage, to kill that many people in that short a period of time without a very specific kind of weapon.
Mudafa in Quincy, Massachusetts is on the line. Mudafa, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
My condolences to the victims' families.
Yes, I think many people agree, and thank you very much for stating that. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I want to shed the light on the main factor in this tragic incident, although I accept the factor of anti-gay or gun violence. But the major factor or the motive is the ideology of Wahhabism or Salafi that is manifests itself into the teaching and the breaching by so many mosques financed by the Saudi government or the Saudi philanthropy.
Let me ask you that. Can I ask you a question? Because I got another guest I've got to get in here. But Mudafa, how do you feel as someone who's Muslim? Mudafa, how do you feel as someone who is Muslim about the gunman here using Islam as an excuse for terror?
Yes, ma'am. And let me give you the example of, a practical example of what kind of Muslim is this monster who did the crimes. Just last week, they discovered a mass grave in Fallujah of 400 soldiers, Iraqi soldiers, slaughtered by ISIS. ISIS is not about the propaganda from the internet or by the internet. ISIS is a school of thought that is being taught on a daily basis. in Saudi Arabia. ISIS is the media that's financed by the Saudi and Qatari, that it's presenting their ideology, restrict ideology, which basically has the doctrine of total war against Muslims, against Christians, now against gay, against everyone.
A perversion of the faith. Mudava, I thank you so much. I'm sorry I have to let you go here, but I appreciate you calling. I'm going to go now to New Britain, Connecticut. Senator Chris Murphy is on the line, Democratic senator from Connecticut. When he was a congressman, his district included Newtown, Connecticut. Senator, so glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you represented Newtown, of course, lived through that horrific massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. In a statement yesterday, you accused Congress of being complicit in the Orlando nightclub murders by its, quote, total, unconscionable, deafening silence on the issue of gun violence. Your thoughts the day after this worst mass killing in U.S. history?
We know this devastation, how deep and how never-ending it is, having gone through it, still going through it in Newtown. So your first emotion, my first emotion is grief and sorrow. But then I have this this emotion of anger as well, because I think that history does teach us that silence in the face of atrocity equals complicity. And I do believe, and I know my colleagues don't love it when I say this, but I do believe that our very intentional silence, our planful ignorance of this epidemic, sends a quiet message of endorsement to individuals who become unhinged, who start to contemplate mass murder. If they don't see the highest levels of government doing anything, even having a debate to try to stop it through changes in gun policy, to more resources for law enforcement, then I think they take the message that the highest levels of authority in their country must not care about the decision they're about to make. So I think there are practical things that we can do to make this epidemic less likely to continue, but I also really worry about the message we send by just going back to business as usual this week and debating appropriations bills rather than sitting down and talking about how we stop this from happening.
Here's a comment from one of our listeners who says, if Ted Cruz can bring government to a halt over Obamacare, why can't someone like Chris Murphy bring Congress to a halt over the slaughter of children and of our friends? Your response, Senator Murphy.
Well, I'm going to be back in Washington this afternoon, and I'm going to be asking the question of leadership. Why aren't we talking this week about bringing this Congress together on an issue like making sure that individuals who are on the terrorist watch list can't buy guns? And I think there will be some of us who will suggest that we shouldn't continue debating all these other measures unless we have taken a stab at trying to find common ground on this issue. Now, this isn't easy because it's not just a matter of gun policy. This is a complicated storyline, and we can't deny the fact that ISIS is attempting to weaponize individuals in the United States and Europe that live on society's fringes that might be susceptible to radicalization. We've got to talk about that as well. So it's not just about gun policy, but it doesn't appear as if we're going to have any of those conversations this week in the United States Senate. That's what's so happening.
Well, months after the Newtown massacre, the Senate tried but failed to pass a measure expanding background checks on firearm purchases. I mean, there's so much to this debate, and we don't have time here to get into each detail. But I heard someone say yesterday, are we just resigned to accepting the fact that these mass shootings are like hurricanes, that they're just going to happen one after the next, over and over and over?
Yeah, and many people have said versions of this, but of course, if 20 dead first graders lying on their classroom floor doesn't change this debate, then what will? And this is a massacre of epic and historic scale, but you wonder whether or not we have just hardened in our views on this question. I mean, let's be honest. The weapon of choice today of would-be terrorists or people who claim to be acting in the name of groups like ISIS is the assault weapon. They are not building bombs in their basement. They are going to stores, and they are legally buying military-style weapons that are capable of killing lots and lots of people in a short amount of time. So it speaks to common sense to suggest that maybe we should take that weapon of choice away from them, especially when doing so doesn't infringe on anyone's ability to exercise their Second Amendment rights. It was Justice Scalia himself who said that the Second Amendment is not a protection to own any type of weapon under any circumstances. I think we have to recognize that's the trend line of these attackers, is to use these weapons.
Let me get Paul in here on that point from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Paul. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jen. I just wanted to say that I agree wholly with the fact that I don't believe it infringes on anyone's Second Amendment rights to take away assault weapons. These are weapons that were clearly designed to kill large or injure large amounts of people at a time. There's no defense to say, oh, this, I can't defend myself if I only have a handgun or a shotgun.
Paul, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Back to you, Senator Murphy. I mean, where do we go from here? Do you see this defining this presidential election, or are we just sort of moving forward as it was?
Well, I think this is going to define the presidential election in a number of ways. Certainly, the issue of gun policy, we already knew, was going to be front and center. Hillary Clinton has made it a central tenet of her campaign and of her platform. And so we were going to be litigating this issue of background checks, of assault weapons restrictions in this election. But then there's a secondary argument that's going to play out, which is who is the commander-in-chief that is best able to stop the potential radicalization of American citizens? And what we know from every expert who talks about this subject is that Donald Trump's focus on marginalizing Muslim communities, on banning their entry into the country, plays directly into the hands of ISIS and radical recruiters.
Well, there are a lot of people. I'm going to jump in here for time's sake. Chris Murphy, Senator, who support that position. J.M. Berger, I'm going to let you have the last word on this.
Well, certainly the xenophobic rhetoric that we're seeing right now in this election and in Europe as well is very problematic. It really undercuts efforts to engage Muslim communities. I mean, you know, it's not a case, I don't think, of blaming the victim. I think that you have to really look at this as a broad and complicated ecosystem. And what you want is to get as many people cooperatively working toward a better world as you can get. So I think, you know, the politics of division are very much against that.
To be continued. Thank you very much. A wonderful panel today. J.M. Berger, fellow with the program on extremism at George Washington University. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Jane.
Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, from New Britain, Connecticut. Senator, thank you for your time, sir. I'm
thank
Jane
you.
Clayson. This is On Point.